Good evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, I'll be speaking with Kelly MacDonald, directing A Piece of My Heart. It's the story of several women before, during, and after the war in Vietnam. That's opening March 23rd at the Redlands Footlighters Theater. We'll also hear from Michael Orland, heavily involved with American Idol for quite some time. We're going to start with The Courage to Rise, a recent book by Liz Arch, a book designed to help yourself. Taylor Milliner has more.
According to your new book, The Courage to Rise, using movement, mindfulness, and healing foods to triumph over trauma, you discussed how trauma lingers in us in three forms: the body, the brain, and the gut. So what led you to writing this book?
The inspiration for the book was really my own personal journey of healing trauma and seeing firsthand how these tools that are in the book changed my life, and also seeing how they created really profound transformations for the clients that I work with, and then wanting to just offer them in a really accessible format for other people.
And so depression and anxiety are becoming more common in the United States every day. What would you say are the contributing factors, specifically factors that we can actually control?
Yeah, there are so many contributing factors, environmental factors, lifestyle, who we surround ourselves with, the constant 24-hour news cycle, studies coming out now about social media and the impact and effect that that has on our brains, especially young children that are growing up in this kind of new media age. So those are some very simple things that we can control, where of just allowing ourselves to unplug and not always having to be plugged in to this, you know, 24-hour news cycle. And then really looking at other places where we can holistically start to find natural solutions to healing our body, mind, and spirit. And one of the biggest places where we can heal our own bodies and things like depression is through our food choices. What we put on the end of our fork, what's on our plate, can either exacerbate mental health issues or can be really healing for our bodies. So that's one of the places that I like to start with.
Yeah, that's great. And what would you say are your most effective top three healing foods?
For me, I reach for probiotics. So probiotics are beneficial live bacteria that help improve immune function and reduce inflammation, aid digestion, and nutrient absorption. What I always like to say is it's not what we eat, it's what we absorb. So
right.
Probiotics can be very helpful for that. So those are found in fermented foods, or you can take them in capsule form. But I personally love kimchi. I eat kimchi all the time.
That's crazy, because I was just going to ask you which
like
type.
That.
So I'm glad you said.
Uh-huh. Yes, so kimchi, kefir, miso, sauerkraut, and then incorporating healthy fats. Our brains are actually made up of more than 60% fat, and so we really need healthy fats for optimal brain function. So I incorporate a lot of avocados in my diet, olive oil. Mm-hmm. I don't eat fish, but I do take a fish oil supplement, which can be really helpful.
Okay.
So things like that. So healthy fats.
Is that a personal choice, or do you just not like fish?
I personally don't like the taste of fish.
That's funny.
So it's more palatable.
I would agree with you. I would agree with you on that.
That's
hilarious. So are there any foods that are great for you, but you simply do not like? Do you find a way to replace that type of food?
So it's about kind of changing our palate. And you can do that slowly, shift it over time. So there are certain things. I have an 11-month-old at home right now, and I'm just really noticing, you know, what I feed him now is really going to create his microbiome in his gut and set him up either for success in the future or not. So it's interesting. I'm exploring with him things like sour taste. A lot of in Western culture, we don't often gravitate towards that sour taste like some of these fermented foods. So our palate is more shaped towards sugar, right? Really sugary or really salty. And so finding some of these more neutralizing flavors are really, yeah.
Exactly. And so you mentioned your son. As a busy mom, how are you able to maintain eating healthy?
It's very challenging, but I like to cook as many meals from home as possible. I think when we go out, when I talked about sugar is everywhere. It's hidden in every single food, especially packaged food, restaurant food. So I like to prepare as many meals from home as possible, but it's definitely a struggle to find
right.
the time.
How do you manage your time doing all of that? How do you make that possible?
So some days I definitely do it better than others. I would love to pretend like I have it all figured out, but I kind of think that balance is a myth, and it's really looking at what is most necessary and important in whatever the moment holds. So really anchoring into the present moment. And sometimes that present moment is me prioritizing my self-care. So taking 5 minutes to do some gentle yoga or breathing exercises. Sometimes the priority in that moment is my son's health and well-being if, you know, something's happening with him. So it's just finding what's most important.
And if you don't mind me asking, what does your everyday food routine look like? What do you find yourself eating the most and the least?
I start off every morning with a smoothie, and I love to incorporate really healthy fats into the smoothie. So whether it's avocado or I blend in flax seeds or almond butter, again, to help with that optimal brain function. And then always a helping of greens, whether it's spinach or kale, and then blending it with either use some sort of fruit or berries. It's wonderful. And it's a great way for me, too, to get nutrition to my son. And he doesn't, you know, even realize that it's loaded with so many amazing things.
So you kind of mix and match your smoothies, you would say.
Okay. Yeah. So I do smoothies. I just had for lunch a bowl of homemade lentil soup. That's actually the recipe is in the book. So just really nourishing gut healing using anti-inflammatory spices like turmeric.
Okay.
So those sorts of things.
What do you find yourself eating the least as far as healthy foods?
Oh, as far as healthy foods, eating the least. That is a great question.
I know you said fish was one of them, but...
Yeah, fish. That's definitely one. So I don't eat fish, but I do supplement with the fish oil. I don't eat red meat, and red meat can have, you know, B vitamins, but I tend to go more towards leaner meats. I could definitely do more bone broth. That has a lot of gut healing properties.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But in general, I really love healthy food.
We can tell, and it's great.
Food, so it's finding.
Right. That's great. That's great. And do you mind describing for us what is different in your life being a newly published author?
It's been really wonderful just to get out and speak about the book and then see what kind of ripple effect it's having. So receiving emails from people that have, you know, heard me on the radio or on podcasts and then have actually read the book and held it in their hands and shared with me the transformation that it's having in their own life is really meaningful to me. And that's why I wrote it in the first place.
Right. And I'm sure you get a lot of people that say that it's transformed their life, right?
Yeah, it's been really special to see, and people sending me, you know, messages on social media. One woman just sent me a picture of her and her mom reading the book together and making some of the recipes in the book. So it's been very, very special to witness.
So I know you mentioned before about the social media and unplugging. Do you try to stay away from social media? Is that easy for you? Is it hard? How do you kind of maintain that balance?
It's really challenging for me. It's very challenging. And I find myself getting stuck in kind of these addictive patterns. And there's, you know, emerging research now that's showing how social media can actually affect our brains and how it can lead to, we think we're connecting, but it actually leads to more social isolation. And then this compare culture of comparing ourselves to everyone's highlight reel, which is what most people post on social media. They don't necessarily post about the down points or the low points. They only post the glamorized high point. So I just really make it a priority in my own life to set boundaries. Mm-hmm. I still, you know, fall into the trap every now and then.
As most people do.
Scrolling. But what I try to do is set like time frames for myself. I can check it 3 times a day and, you know, it's at this set time. Otherwise, it's my phone's on airplane mode in a drawer.
So where can people find more of your work?
I am online at my website at lizarch.com. I'm also on Instagram at lizarch or Facebook and Twitter at Primal Yoga.
And we have one more question just to wrap it up. Do you see yourself having a sequel with The Courage to Rise?
I would love to just continue to share more tools. So absolutely, there's more. There's always more to write there. It's a growing field, and it's just talking about healing. There's always more to be healed.
Always more to come, right?
Yes.
All right, perfect. Thank you, Liz. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Have a great day.
That was Taylor Milliner in conversation with Liz Arch about her recent book, The Courage to Rise, Using Movement, Mindfulness, and Healing Foods to Triumph Over Trauma. More at lizarch.com. You're with 91.9 KVCR, streaming live at kvcrnews.org. As KVC Arts continues, we'll hear from Kelly MacDonald, directing A Piece of My Heart. It's the story of several women before, during, and after the war in Vietnam. It's opening March 23rd at the Redlands Footlighters Theater. Later, we'll also hear from Michael Orland, who was an arranger, vocal coach, and associate music director for American Idol. He was there for close to a decade and a half. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, we'll hear from Michael Orland and some of his experiences with American Idol. First, though, we welcome Kelly MacDonald, directing A Piece of My Heart by Shirley Laurel. This opens March 23rd and runs until when? This is at the Redlands Footlighters Theater.
Yes, it runs through April 14th, so we run for 4 weekends.
4 weekends. Okay, now are those actual weekends, Friday, Saturday, Sunday? Is it a Thursday through Saturday kind of thing?
The first weekend is just Saturday and Sunday, but the remaining 3 weekends are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Okay. A Piece of My Heart, this isn't one of those that everybody's heard of, you know, your chorus line, your cats, etc. So just to let people know a little bit about this, give us that sentence or three that tells us about the play and hopefully draws us in.
It's about women who served during the Vietnam War, more specifically 6 women, and the stories are actually based on true women who served during the Vietnam War as nurses, Red Cross. One of the characters in the play is based off of the women who went over to entertain the troops, and one of the characters is based off of an intelligence officer that was on our side in the war. And it takes place before the war, during the war, and the effects on the women after the war.
So some of these women, you will see the same woman at these 3 different time periods. You will see how this person is affected?
Yeah, you will see all of them.
Okay.
The beginning, the middle, and the end. They all had different viewpoints on the war before they went in, and everything happens. And then when they come home, they deal with what the soldiers dealt with when they came home from the war, the protests, having to deal with the PTSD, but not having really the mental health provided for them. So having to struggle through that.
If a person goes to ShirleyLauro.com, there are a couple of trailers for A Piece of My Heart. Now, one of them, though, it would lead a person to think that the play is just a series of monologues. All right, so if you would, tell us how the story is told. There are monologues, but it's not just that.
Correct. You'll see a bunch of different scenes. So the women play themselves, but they also take turns playing other characters, other nurses, other officers. So you'll get snippets of scenes, and you also get the women almost narrating what they went through. So it's not necessarily a normal play in the fact that it has a very beginning, middle, and end, but we get to see monologues, and we also get to see little scenes that help tell the story of what the women went through.
Nice. Okay. Gotcha. Well, now, before going further, how about a bit about you? You've been active in this area for quite some time in the world of theater.
Yeah, I actually got my bachelor's degree in acting from Cal State San Bernardino. After I graduated, I started working in the community. My daytime job is at UCR. And after a couple of years, I decided to go to grad school. So I was accepted to the University of Essex East 15 Acting School in London. So I was in London for 2 years getting my master's degree in directing.
Wow.
And now I'm back working a day job and also directing at night whenever I can.
Theater is, if a person is immersed in it and they grow up doing it or it's been such a strong part of their life at some point, it's hard to truly stop and get away from it. It's like that Godfather 3 reference they kept drawing me back in. Oh, there's
That's
an added
exactly
point.
What it feels like. There's also one man character in the play.
Oh, okay.
And currently the actor that I was able to get to play him is somebody that I worked with a couple years ago when I did the play The 39 Steps at the Footlighters. And he hasn't done anything in a little bit, so he felt like he was you know, crawling back in.
Yes, that's exactly it. Talk about why or what made you want to direct this one. The type of play, something within it. You know, it's nowhere what we'd call fluff.
Oh, yeah. I personally am always interested in plays that move audiences to tears or strong laughter, something that makes them leave and think about the play for days to come. And I saw this play several years ago and knew instantly that one day I would direct it. Now getting this opportunity, I am so thankful for the Footlighters to let me direct it because it's such an important play for history. Because not a lot of people know about women or think about women in terms of the Vietnam War. It wasn't really even started to be discussed until like the 1980s. And somebody went around who interviews with women who served and volunteered for the Vietnam War. And from there, that's where this play came from. That book is also called A Piece of My Heart. It's such an important part of history that could so easily be lost and so easily forgotten about because a lot of these women don't talk about it and they don't work through their feelings of what happened. So in honor of those women, this play needs to be out there. It needs to be talked about. We need to have more recognition of what they went through, and they're heroes in their own right.
Oh, absolutely. Talk a little bit more about the characters, and I mean really their place within the narrative. You know, we have an intelligence officer, a singer, and a bunch of nurses. So in addition to what the character is like, I'm saying what function do they serve to propel this story? This might be the toughest question on this page.
But it's tough because I think what's so important to each character is they all come from different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. There's one character where her family is military-based. So her saying she was going to go over and be a nurse and serve during the war, they were all very proud and happy for her. And when she came home and was broken and didn't know how to handle what she had been through, they were disappointed when she said she wasn't going to sign up for a second tour. Mm-hmm. And it's important to pay attention to that because these women needed support, just like the soldiers needed support when they came home. And they came home to angry mobs protesting them and not being celebrated like the soldiers who came home from World War I and World War II. So it was just a different environment, and there wasn't a lot of support.
Absolutely.
So there's a woman that was protesting the war beforehand and decided to go over to help and to make a difference in the world and try to be a nurse is a very healing practice. So when she came home, she ended up actually fighting against the fact that there's a lot of people that say Agent Orange didn't exist and diseases that came back from the war. And she was able to get a bill passed and through legislation and then continue to protest and help the country eventually heal. A woman that came from a very proper home, and what she goes through, she ends up having and creating a support group for all the women and letting them have a place to open up and express their feelings and discuss in a room of people who actually understand what they went through. There's a woman that gets pushed to her very limit, and I don't know, I don't want to give too much away without, you know, spoilers.
Sure.
It's a very moving story that's very important to history, and I say bring tissues for sure.
I actually had that written down to ask you. I truly did. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Kelly MacDonald about A Piece of My Heart, opening soon at the Redlands Footlighters Theater. More at redlandsfootlighters.org. By the way, is this presented in the round?
The Footlighters Theater isn't technically in the round because of the shape isn't round. Uh-huh. It's more of a what I would refer to as a hallway stage. The stage is a rectangle, essentially, and there's uh-huh. audience on both sides. So you have to play or direct the show as if it's in the round. I always tell my actors to work towards the corners and play diagonally uh-huh. so both sides of the theater can see your faces. Because this show has so many little different scenes, I try to give both sides of the stage face time with each of the characters and special moments. So when you're directing, you have to pay attention to where people will be sitting in the theater and making sure that every seat is a good seat.
It's fair to say the challenges perhaps may just be simply somewhat typical, as you've already addressed. The big challenge of the round is your back's always to someone. The directing your lines in a diagonal fashion, that just changes my concept of watching in the round, period. But were there any challenges specific to this play for directing in this fashion?
Well, all six women are on stage the entire time. There's not entrances or exits for them. So keeping in mind where everybody is at any given point and where the focus should be is a difficult task in itself. And making sure that if anyone's back is to one side of the audience, that it's not there for that long. And if their back is to the audience, and they're speaking, they need to work on volume to make sure that everyone in front of them and behind them can hear them and not miss parts of the story that are important.
Gotcha. Now, when a person hears the title of the play, they might go right to the Janis Joplin song. The song does appear in the play, yes?
Yes, it
okay.
will.
So talk about how and when it's used.
Well, the show has a lot of music in it from the actual time period.
Oh, cool.
And the singer will be singing throughout the show little bits here and there. It's not a musical by any means, but it does contain music within it. And there will be underscore music through a couple of scenes to help create a different atmosphere. I won't tell you when A Piece of My Heart will be played, but I can assure you it will be played at some point during the show. And if you like the music from the time period, then you'll definitely enjoy the singing. The actress that we have who will do the singing, her voice is absolutely beautiful. When she came to audition, she wasn't prepared to sing a song. She was looking at other characters.
Oh.
But I asked everybody if they wanted to do it. So she just jumped up and sang Happy Birthday, and it was like the beautifulest rendition of Happy Birthday I'd ever heard. And I said, well, if she wants the part, she's got it.
Wow. Well, if that weren't a great tease to get us in, that I don't know what one might be. That's fantastic. How about now, something within the play that you, Kelly, will never tire of? And here I am looking for something rather specific, a line that grabs you every time. Or you've gone through this 140 times at least by now.
Yes. One of my favorite parts, it's such a small part too. One of the interviews I did during research was about a soldier who was in the Vietnam War, and he talks about how humanity can be so very cruel to each other. And that's so true, especially in war. But in the play, there's one little bit where a Gold Star father comes up to one of the nurses in an airport. She's lost and she doesn't know where she's going and no one's communicating with her. And he says, hey, I'm a Gold Star father. My child died in Vietnam. I go around and pick up as many people as I can who are coming home, and I drive them to their next location to make sure that they get to their next plane on time so they can get home to their family. And that, to me, is such a beautiful moment showing such human kindness, especially after such tragedy that they've been through and what they've seen.
That's absolutely incredible.
It's a positive point because there's so much sadness and descriptions of violence through the play. They even talk about how the children of Vietnam were affected, from a child who was part of the VC to children who were just innocent bystanders who got their hands chopped off. And it's so, so heartbreaking. And the way these women bring these stories to life in front of me, even during rehearsals, I start to tear up, because they're just so committed to making sure that these stories are told properly and coming to life. And I mean, I tell my actresses all the time, I love you guys. You guys are doing such a fantastic job. And I'm so excited for people to see it.
If we were going to try to draw somebody in, again, you've done it over and over and you just did it again. Do you have other shows on the back burner? Something coming up?
I don't, actually.
Wow.
But if anybody wants to give me one, I'm open.
All right. Well, how about a few bucket list shows, both as an actor, a bucket list show that you would want to direct? I want to know why, not just some title.
Okay. For acting, I love improv. And I really don't like memorizing lines, which is why directing fits me perfectly. So I would like to do more improv. And when I was in school in London, I worked with a company that was an improv company that taught improv to people who weren't necessarily theater people. They were looking to try something new after work instead of going home and just watching TV. And being around creative people who are different than the theater creative mind was incredible, and it opened up my senses. So I would love to do something more like that. In terms of directing, oh, there's so many. But the first one that pops in my head is Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Okay.
I really like absurd theater and things, again, that make you think and that are unusual and passionate. And that play is so full of passion and strangeness. And I think it would be a lot of fun. It would be a hard challenge. It would be great if I could find the great actors and actresses to be in the show. Only four characters are in the play, so it's very actor-heavy. And it would be a lot of fun.
Yeah. You're really drawn to the intense, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Gotcha. Okay.
Well, I like to have my rehearsal rooms be a lot of fun, a lot of character and actor bonding, and it helps get through the tough plays, and it helps connect everybody. So in the end, there's this strong connection that you can see on stage, and it helps bring to life these strong pieces.
And again, there's a rather impressive accolade on this play too, yes?
Yeah, the Vietnam's Vet Association has said about this play that it is the most enduring play on Vietnam in the nation. So having their full support is fantastic.
Absolutely. Again, tell us where and when people can see A Piece of My Heart.
You can see A Piece of My Heart at the Redlands Footlighters Theater starting Saturday, March 23rd. And we run for 4 weekends, and our closing show will be April 14th. The show does contain adult language, adult situations, descriptions of violence that may not be suitable for children under 13 or anyone that's struggling with war PTSD. This might trigger somebody.
My gosh, wow. Kelly, again, I can't thank you enough for your time. I really look forward to seeing this.
Thank you. I'm so excited myself. And thank you so much for your help and your support in this.
That was Kelly McDonald directing A Piece of My Heart, opening March 23rd at the Redlands Footlighters Theater. More at redlandsfootlighters.org. Up in just over a minute, we'll have Jonathan Linden in conversation with Michael Orland, who wore many hats over his nearly a decade and a half with American Idol. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. For the remainder of the program now, a glimpse into a bit of popular culture through Michael Orland. If you don't recognize the name, maybe you recognize the theme playing in the background. If neither, well, KVCR's Jonathan Linden has more.
Something you are most well known for is that you were actually like a music coach on American Idol for the first 16 seasons of production, right?
Yes. It will always be a claim to fame. It was the best, you know, like to get a TV show to be on for 16 years for anybody is like, you know, gold, and it doesn't happen a lot. But my official title was associate musical director, but in layman's terms, I was a pianist, vocal coach, and arranger, and part-time therapist, and all that, and best friend to like every contestant that went through that door. It was a gift, and I will always be grateful for it, and it changed my life for the better, mostly in all the people I got to meet and mentor and become lifelong friends with. So it was so great.
So basically, any contestant that was on the show, you had the opportunity to work with firsthand, or?
In the beginning, it was just one team of vocal coaches. And I think on season four, when this brilliant musician, Ricky Minor, came on to head up the music department, he was like, why is one team doing all this work? And so they brought in a second coaching team. And then even like in the later days, when it got so crazy with so many contestants, they ended up bringing in a third team. And so that's how it was the last bunch of years. But So at some point, though, we worked with everybody because each of the coaching teams would take, you know, a group song that one week. And so I absolutely worked with everybody. And also I was like the first person that got to meet everybody at Hollywood Week in the big, huge mass thing where they bring, you know, 180 people and that go down to like in 4 days, they whittle it down to like 50 people. So I got my first time with everybody then. But even before then, I think it was around season four, which was the year Carrie Underwood won. I said to my two bosses, Ken Warwick and Nigel Lift, who ran that show in its heyday when it was, you know, getting 30 million viewers every week. You know, they had all these producers going out on the road in the summer for the auditions. And I was like, why don't you guys bring any music people? Maybe somebody's falling through the crack because they're not finding, you know, they're missing a great, you know, musician or a great singer that's, you know, a great vocalist, whatever. And so they're like, okay, well, what are you doing this summer? And I was like, nothing. They're like, great, come on the road. So starting like in season four for about 12 years, I also went on the road with all the auditions where, you know, we get 5,000 people in one day singing. And that was pretty remarkable experience.
Were you doing like the kind of pre-auditions where you were kind of screening people before they were going in front of the main judges? Or?
Exactly, yeah. So what happens, there was always three rounds. They never really publicized like the way they did it because, but now it's very, they're very open about how it works. There's like three rounds audition for, so you have to first go to this big stadium call where it's literally a bunch of producers, and I got to be joining them for over years. They go through that round. If you make it through to that round, then you go another, the next round, you go see the executive producers. Then you have to make it through that round before they send you to the judges. And then the judges say, okay, you're going through the Hollywood Week. So there's a lot that people don't get to see. Well, they never really saw on television before. People used to think that people came into this big open field and went right in to see Paula and Randy and Simon, which is not the case.
So out of all those years, do you have a few people that stand out to you that left an impact on you with their singing or whatever it may be that you got to work with firsthand?
Well, I tell you, I mean, honestly, it's like saying to a parent, who's your favorite kid? I loved every single one of these seasons, and even the ones that didn't do as well, and even the people that got voted off early that still have beautiful careers in music and theater and whatever. And I really, every single one of them, I loved every single thing. But there were definitely, of course, there was, you know, Adam Lambert, one of the most gracious people I ever worked with in my life, and just such a superstar, like from day one. Those are the people like you see when they come in, you go, oh, there's something going on here. I saw that with Catherine McPhee. I saw that with Jordan Sparks. I saw that with Lauren Elena. I mean, so everybody, I don't want to single out people because literally I love every single one of these people. I still work with a lot of them today. Melinda Doolittle, Chris Allen, I mean, like all these people. But there were two people that literally called me out and thanked me like on stage in front of millions.
Wow.
And that was Adam Lambert. And Casey Abrams did, and Pia Toscano. Like, Pia Toscano was just one of the most beautiful and talented people. She was on season 10. She was cut a little bit early. That was the year Jennifer Lopez was a judge. It was, like, mind-boggling. This girl had the most unbelievable voice. As a matter of fact, when she came into the field to audition, the big stadium, I found her, and I was like, oh, my God, this girl is a freaking superstar. And then she got cut very early. Well, she ended up going on to be one of Jennifer Lopez's background singers for years. And now she travels with David Foster as one of his vocalists. She's an unbelievable vocalist and better now than ever. And just, you know, like just people like that. But really, they're all like my kids. And I feel like definitely besides a friend and a coach and a pianist, I definitely feel like a parent. So many of them, I'm very protective.
When you were working with them, like, how much time were you working personally with each contestant?
Well, you know, the thing I loved about Idol, because it was a contest, everything had to be all even, all equal. Everybody, like, would normally get an hour of rehearsal for, like, 2 days in a row. It seems like so little for a music show, but there were so many things these contestants were doing besides music. It's so funny. It was a singing show, but they had to go shopping for their outfits. They had to go in the recording studio and sing their iTunes song, do meet and greets. They had so much to do. They had to learn choreography for their group number. It was the smallest amount of time was spent on their music, so that you really had to have a good work ethic to make it in that show. And the ones that made it that far all did. And the ones that are still successful today are all because not just talented, but they have this crazy work ethic. But we used to literally get like an hour with each kid 2 days in a row, to go over their songs for that week. And if somebody struggled and needed more time, then we had to offer that extra time to every single person. It was really the most fair thing I'd ever seen. So everything was about fairness and all that stuff, and I loved that. And there were some people that came in and knew exactly what they wanted to do, like a Chris Daughtry or Taylor Hicks, or Adam Lambert came in and said, you know, Disco Week, I want to make this into a killer ballad, like, and knew exactly what he wanted to do, and he was in and out in 30 minutes, you know, like, because they were just very clear. And then there was, the next week, they would maybe struggle a little bit because the rock boy had to sing a country song, and he was, you know, freaking out, and he needed a little extra time. So it really varied.
Well, I feel like we could talk a lot about your experience with Idol. It sounds like there's a lot there. But I also want to get more into some of your other professional experiences. You have a close relationship with Kristen Chenoweth, if I'm correct, right? Or
yes, I do. I just love that woman so much. She is not only a Tony Award winner, but an Emmy Award winner. And she's so talented. It's unreal. And I've been so lucky to have had the opportunity to travel with her a lot and tour with her a lot and play piano for her. And I also do a lot of rehearsing with her when she's in L.A. She goes back and forth between L.A. and New York, and she has this amazing musical director on the East Coast, Mary Mitchell Campbell, who she also does most of her stuff with. But she's in L.A. right now. As a matter of fact, as soon as we're done with this interview, I am going into the studio because she's finishing up an album that I've been helping her with, and the amazing Steve Tyrell, I don't know if you know him, he's a brilliant musician, and he's producing the album, and so we've been working on that on and off for like the last 6 months, and we're actually going to finish it the next 2 weeks.
Well, that's so cool.
I'm actually going to be in the studio all day with her today and tomorrow. She's the most beautiful, generous, talented. I mean, like, if I had to teach a course in how to perform and how to be yourself on stage and how to just be natural and be appealing to everybody in the audience, young, old, women, men, everything, I would say come watch what Kristen Chenoweth does. You know, somebody who can just be that honest and real and wear their emotions on their sleeves and do everything, a country, pop, jazz, opera, classical. I mean, like, she does everything, comedy, wow. You know, and she just does all of it, and she's so real that the audience, even the few that come in there, they don't know who she is, they leave, like, just blown away. They leave blown away. But it's been an amazing blessing working with her, and I've learned so much.
Yeah, and she, I follow you on Instagram, and I see you, you've actually, like, she does a lot of community work stuff in, like, Idaho, correct?
Yeah, she's done a lot of stuff. You know, we recently did this beautiful private party in Idaho, and in the middle of the show, she announced that she was donating her fee to this beautiful theater that's there, the Argyros Theater. And she has her own Kristen Chenoweth Theater that's in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. She does this Broadway boot camp there that I've been blessed to do the last 2 years and hopefully going back this summer. And it's her legacy. It's like she wants to leave her name on that. And it's like the most amazing experience. And she's very big into, you know, letting young theater people make their mark on this world and have the chances that she had, because it's, you know, it's so different now in the business. She's got her hand in everything, records, selling jewelry, clothing, performing, movies, Broadway, TV. I mean, she does everything. It's unreal. And I'm such a huge fan of hers.
That's Michael Orland from American Idol in conversation with Jonathan Linden. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org.
Michael, do you personally have any, like, albums that you've released on your own time, or are you mainly, like, assisting?
You know, I mean, I've worked on so many people's albums and produced a few. I literally started working on a solo piano CD of, like, I was going to do, like, a piano thing of all, like, show tunes and stuff. I started it. I never finished it because everything got so busy. I still want to do it. I have a bunch of tracks already started. You know, the whole music business is so funky and different now, but it is something I will do. I am currently writing a lot of songs with a writing partner of mine who lives in Boston, Stacey Gruber, and we've been working on a bunch of upcoming potential TV projects and whatnot and a big feature film, and that's being currently done and whatever. It's all, like, you know, it's a crapshoot, anything with, you know, songwriting stuff, but I hope to be making a mark really soon with all that stuff. I've had a bunch of singers record some of my songs and stuff, and I've been trying to get it out there, but it's so hard today to get your songs out there unless you write with the artist or the artist wants, you know, 80% of the song they didn't even write that you wrote. You know, that's the reality of the business today.
Okay.
That's why when I see sheet music and it's got eight people's names on it, I'm like, what? What are they making, $1.99 each when they sell 100, you know, 100,000?
Yeah.
It's crazy, but that's the reality of the business today.
You would say the business is more maybe crammed and it's hard to...
Well, you know, people don't get those record deals anymore and people release singles and there, I think there's no like mold to fit in anymore. I think that's what I find encouraging. The good part is I have a lot of students. I do vocal coaching at home all day, every day. And I find like there's no rule anymore. There's no such thing as too old anymore for the record business. Someone can be 35 years old and still make it and still, you know, have success and still find that next thing that goes viral or that catches on or a song that gets put in a movie that gets on. You know what I mean? Like, there's no more rules. That's what is so great. You just have to be the next big one to get discovered or to, you know, to go viral, whatever it is. But that's the good part of it. It's just, it's a weird business. Nobody's getting radio play except, you know, the big ones that get it. And I think, you know, for me, I'm a huge country music fan. I love country music. I think it's still got beautiful melodies, gorgeous lyrics, beautiful stories. Really, everybody can sing. There's no vocal tricks going on with, you know, those singers in Nashville and stuff. And I'm such a huge fan of that still, and I believe that will never go away.
Do you feel like streaming services like Spotify and Apple Music have really changed the environment of how musicians are making money and who's becoming popular nowadays? Or?
Oh, for sure. I think it definitely is big. I think I had this conversation with the amazing, one of my idols, David Foster. And, you know, he thinks the system, the way they are doing all that stuff is all great for writers. I think writers just aren't making the money they used to make in the old days, but he agrees that the system they have now is working and it is right. And I just think like that heyday of, you know, making billions in the 70s and 80s that songwriters made. And I'm working on a project with the incredible John Farrar, who, you know, he is one of the biggest, and he wrote every Olivia Newton-John hit song. And he's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant writer, and I'm working on a new project with him right now. And, you know, like that, I can't even imagine. I'd love to talk to him about what he thinks, because, you know, in the old days, they were making the big, huge bucks. And now, you know, it's different now. They're still making money, but it's just different. But I think that it is what it is right now. And I think, you know, everything's a digital download. Most people release singles, not whole albums, or, you know, they put on an EP and stuff. I think it's like, again, anything goes, which is what I do love about the way it's changed. You know, in the beginning of American Idol, people made an album, and it went on the top of the charts, and everybody, Kelly Clarkson and Clay Aiken and Ruben and Carrie Underwood and Jordan Sparks got huge airplay, you know, huge. And then it slowly started changing. You know, you have to remember, in the old days of Idol, there was no social media. The contestants would jump around this big desktop computer that had like a dial-up modem, and they would all take turns looking at the AOL pages to see what people were saying about them. There was no Twitter.
Oh, wow.
There was no Instagram. There was none of that was there yet. And so people who are still big, you know, from the old days of Idol never had social media pages. And then even when social media came on, the shows were monitoring what people were saying. And now by, you know, the last 5 years, they're like, oh, please post about the show. You know, now they beg people to post. It just to watch it all change and stuff, really, with Idol. And, you know, and then the market got swamped with The Voice and America's Got Talent and, you know, The One and all those other shows.
Yeah, there's a bunch of shows now.
Kind of copycat shows.
Before you go, Michael, I do want to ask you one question. For anyone that's interested in getting more involved in music and wanting to maybe pursue a career in music, what would your recommendation be to them?
It's such a hard question, but listen, I encourage everybody to go into music. And or if they're really that, they have to be so into it. Like, I go around the country doing master classes and stuff, and I will say to somebody, I'll point somebody out and say, what do you want to be? What do you want to do when you go to college? And they're like, I don't know if I want to be a singer or I want to be a lawyer. And I said, you need to go to law school. I want to see the people that say, and not only want to be a singer, it's all I can do. It's all I want. I tell people, you can have a plan B and you can do all that, but you got to want it that bad. You have to have that much drive. and that much commitment. And you literally have to be that into it. And listen, do people have to have straight jobs to pay the bills? Yes, but it doesn't mean you're going to be any less passionate about what you want to do. You have to study. You have to learn. You have to. I tell singers all the time, learn every style. Like when I was growing up playing piano, I had to learn classical, and I was like, oh, God. I'm so thankful for that. That was such a basis for, like, everything. People today, especially, like, musical theater people, like, female girls have to learn to belt and do the soprano thing and dance. Literally, I played auditions for Disney on Broadway 5 days last week, and it's like, you got to see what those people all sing, all dance, all act. They have to be ready in 1 second to be able to do all that, and I encourage everybody to try. It's worth a try. It's worth learning. It's worth taking classes, going to dance class, meeting with a vocal coach, and just getting your book in order, whether you're auditioning for musical theater or whether you're auditioning for pop stuff or whether you're auditioning to be in a band, whatever it is, you have to do the work. I know all those reality shows make it look like somebody gets handed fame by not working at it. Not all of it lasts. And unless you have that work ethic and are willing to put the work in, it's not going to happen. And yes, it can happen. It just doesn't always last. You know, there are exceptions to all that, but I encourage anybody to do it. But you got to be so passionate about it. And again, you can have a plan B, but you got to be like, this is it. This is all I want to do. Just to bring it back to me, I went to school because my parents told me I had to be not to go into music because they didn't want me to not do well or whatever. And they wanted me to go be an accountant because I loved math and I loved numbers and everything. I was miserable. I dropped out of school much against my parents. They were not happy about it, although they're fine now. But, you know, like, I wanted music only, and I was willing to do whatever I had to do that. And so, listen, I was lucky. I was in so much of this business is being in the right place at the right time. But you have to be armed with the education to get you through that door when it opens. Being talented doesn't open a door. But it absolutely, when the door opens through somebody or whatever, this whole business is so who you know. And I say meet people all the time, go to showcases, go to, you know, where you can be seen at an open mic night. Those things are all important. But I would encourage anybody to do it.
Thank you again, Michael, for taking some time. Good luck with your recording with Kristen today.
Thank you so much. We're going to have some fun for 2 days.
That was Michael Orland in conversation with KVCR's Jonathan Linden to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Michael Orland, Liz Arch, and Kelly McDonald. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Sharina Wadd, Taylor Milliner, Jonathan Linden, and KVCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Beyond the theme for American Idol and just a touch of Janis Joplin, music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.